I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have read many, many, many tennis books over the years, but I have never read a book I enjoyed as much as this one. It's called The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer, and it is written by Christopher Clary, who is the tennis correspondent for the New York Times and has covered tennis all over the world for the last several decades. And he has, of course, followed the exploits of all kinds of amazing tennis champions over those three decades. And, of course, among the very greatest and the most fascinating, Roger Federer. And Christopher Clary has not only spent a great deal of time with Roger Federer himself and his entourage, but also spoken to all kinds of people in the game of tennis, including some of his fiercest rivals and competitors and friends, in order to shape for us an incredibly vivid portrait of this amazing athlete. And I'm very, very excited for this opportunity to speak with Christopher Clary about his book, again titled The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer, published by 12. Christopher Clary, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, Greg. Thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words about the book. That means a lot.
It occurs to me that, I mean, I happen to be a tennis fan, and I happen to be a fan of Roger Federer, but it seems to me that this is a book that could conceivably be of great interest even to somebody who is not a tennis fan or a Roger Federer fan. Did you consciously go about trying to craft a book that would have that sort of wide appeal?
Yeah, that's a great question, Greg, and that was my goal. Actually, I had two objectives that were sort of in opposition, if you will. One was that I wanted it to be a book that would appeal to people who are, you know, tennis aficionados, tennis nerds like you and me, it sounds like. People who, you know, already knew about Roger and knew a lot about him, but kind of wanted to get into his process and details and remind themselves about, you know, what his path was and how he did things from a very micro level. But I also wanted it to be a book that people like my wife, for example, who is French and really doesn't care much about sports or tennis, could pick up and still have something she could relate to because of the human stories, both Roger's and also his rivals' human stories. And I thought that was really important as I was conceiving the book, that we get a good look in detail at the people that he played against so often, and not just Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic, who are his, you know, longest-standing rivals and most thorny rivals, but also people in the early years like Leighton Hewitt, Andy Roddick, and Murat Safin. To me, that was important to kind of give context to. Otherwise, writing about the forehands and the backhands and these great matches just doesn't have the meaning or resonance for a general audience. So those are the two goals, and that's probably why the book is 420-plus pages long, because I was trying to find a way to bring those two things together.
Right. And one of the things that makes me think that this is a book that even somebody who's not particularly interested in the game of tennis would find a lot to take away is that it's such a rich sort of human portrait of Roger Federer. And the story of how he has managed to achieve such great success beyond kind of the technical matters of exactly how he plays the game in terms of his serve and his backhand and so on. But it is also a story of somebody navigating the complex challenges that are part of being an elite athlete, really in any sport, but really particularly tennis. And it seems to me you've gone out of your way to kind of shape your book with plenty of attention to those kind of matters, as opposed to what was the score when he won Wimbledon in such and such a year.
Yeah, he was very, you know, Greg, he was very methodical and very intentional about trying to master these different parts of his personality and his game and the overall ecosystem of tennis. That's kind of that's the title, you know, the master, that's what it comes from. And it's really, it's been a lifelong quest for him. And he had a lot of obstacles he had to overcome. Did he have to overcome what Novak Djokovic did in terms of, you know, being from a country that was in the middle of violent conflict and having no money and having to leave the country to have any chance of success in his early teens? No, Roger didn't go through that. But he, in his own context, had to go through quite a lot and make a lot of progress, including, you know, conquer his own temperament, which was a real problem for him early on. More than many people remember, he was not the Zen master that we've come to know. He was somebody who had a lot of difficulty processing defeat and his own expectations and would lose control of himself quite often.
Right.
And that's just in his teens. It happened in his early 20s. So all that was part of it. And also on the business side of things, I mean, he came from a situation where he was, one of several candidates for, you know, greatness in tennis, but he wasn't the guy by any means. But he was coming from a small European country that had little tradition in tennis at the highest level. So he had, you know, he couldn't even get his first Nike contract renewed for a while, which is hard to imagine now. And we have an excerpt today in the New York Times magazine about, you know, from the book, the business side of Roger talks about that evolution as well. So he's a guy who has made sort of steady, consistent progress, but has been very intentional in the way he plans and keeps himself fresh mentally in all these different domains.
One of the things that I found most intriguing about the way he is described in your book, and of course some of these facets change over time, is that some of the people who met him early were so struck by his playfulness, his sense of not taking things too seriously. And yet, of course, on the other hand, there were ways in which he took certain things way too seriously. And he himself described himself early on as a terrible loser. But ultimately, there was such mindfulness in terms of the way he went about shaping himself and his game and his attitudes and so on. And it seems like, on the other hand, he never lost this sense of playfulness. It seems like there are two sides of his personality, and we need to understand both of them in order to understand why he has become the champion that he has.
That is a very perceptive comment. I think that's true. I think he's holding these two parts of his personality, you know, there. He's got that. He's also, interestingly, from a, you know, multicultural background himself. His mother is South African, not Swiss. His dad is Swiss, and his parents met in South Africa. So Roger really comes from two cultures, even though he never lived full-time in South Africa. He visited there a lot as a child, and he feels very connected to that country and has both passports. So I think he has that sort of, he would call it a more expansive, extroverted sort of side to him from that sort of South African background, and maybe even thinks there's a bit of American style to that. And then he has the more, I'd say, conservative side with the Swiss, and doesn't like people to make too much of a fuss when he's back there, and he kind of has that sort of aspect to it as well. But you're right, he's a very, in person, a very spontaneous, outgoing, goofy at times guy one-on-one, and you could see a couple years ago, he's at the Australian Open, he's like hiding out in the back tunnel and jumping out and surprising one of his trainers. It's just, you know, he's a guy in his late 30s, and he's still playing pranks like that. So, and he's always had this sort of prankster side to him too. So those are things you wouldn't see when you're watching him with his mask of concentration in a Grand Slam tournament, but they're all there. And I think what's been good is I talk about his intentionality. It's almost like he knows he needs breaks from that pressurized environment to allow himself to recharge and allow himself to take the pressure off. But he also does it during tournaments, too. You can watch him when the match is over. He's able to go back with his family or go back with his friends and kind of just keep it lighter, even though he's got his mind on the games that are coming ahead. But he also is able to take time away and compartmentalize his life in a very effective way. And I think there's a lot for all of us to learn from that.
We're speaking with Christopher Clary, author of The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. At one point in the book, you take up this question that you say has long been debated. Are champions born or made, or more logically, a bit of both? And you say that you favor Martina Navratilova's answer to that question. Champions are born, and then they have to have the right environment to be made. a village is required in a sense. And Roger Federer certainly has been blessed. He would be the first to say so. Very, very blessed in terms of the important figures who have been in his village, so to speak, especially early on when his game and persona were being shaped. Explain to our listeners the two or three of the most significant people that Roger Federer was so fortunate to encounter and work with.
Yeah, I think that's really a pivotal thing here, and there's an element of chance to that for sure, and there is some chance in a couple of those people coming into his life the way they did. But yeah, I'd say the two most important people have been Peter Carter, who was his boyhood coach in Basel, Switzerland, who was Australian from Adelaide, and he was on the edge of the tour level player, and he wasn't quite making it on tour, so he decided to play club tennis, which is pretty common in Europe. So he played for Old Boys, which is the club that Roger was in as a child in Basel, and he ended up sort of showing up out of the blue there as a club player and ended up giving lessons. And so, but he and Peter Carter would ever meet, it's highly unlikely, but they did. And Peter, because of his connection to Australia and his fine style of play and his great personality, really connected with Roger in a way that no other coach might have been able to. And he was able to put him in touch, as Roger was a guy who had no real background in his family from professional sport or high-level sport. But Peter, because of his Australian connections, knew a lot of the great Aussie players of the past and was able to kind of put Roger as a talented junior in touch with those people. And he also understood that Roger was a diamond in the rough and needed special care, and he was not going to be somebody who was going to solve his temperamental problems right away. He needed time to do that. But Peter always believed that Roger could make it at the highest level and be a special, special player, one of the greatest players. And so I think that faith was ultimately very important for Roger, and the careful way that Peter Carter shaped his game and everything from the one-handed backhand to his attacking style to all those different things are partly Peter Carter's legacy. But then, sadly, Peter Carter was killed in a Jeep accident in South Africa in 2002 when Roger was just 21 years old. And Peter Carter's death left a huge mark on Roger. And I think he wasn't working with him as a coach on tour at the time, but they were still very much in contact, and the influence was huge. And I think really Roger at that time was struggling to really make it at the highest level and really establish himself as a Grand Slam champion. And Peter Carter's death in some ways made him grow up fast and made him realize that he wanted to honor what they had done together and honor that legacy and prove Peter Carter right in a way. He even wrote that out in messages to people that knew Peter Carter well. And I think that was his mission, and I think he accomplished it. So Peter Carter was one, and obviously his wife, Mirka, has been a huge factor for Roger, as anybody's wife would be. But in Roger's case, Mirka was a former pro player herself. She was a top 100 player, very talented from Switzerland. Also, Roger's mom was South Africa, so an immigrant to Switzerland. Mirka's parents were from Slovakia, former Czechoslovakia, and they had immigrated, so they had that in common. And Mirka would have been, I think, a top 30 player in the world if she hadn't gotten hurt, and she had chronic foot problems and was unable to continue her career, stopped very, very early in her career in her early 20s. And so I think she, by being so close to Roger and also was being a big part of his business side of his career early on anyway, in their marriage or their relationship, she was able to really remind him just by her very presence of what she had missed, and she didn't want him to miss that as well and to miss out on using his enormous potential and trying to maximize it or get close to it. And I know that she reminded him of that and urged him on that way. And also because of her background as a tennis player, was able to, I think, accept some of the constraints that go with that life. I mean, it's a dramatic lifestyle. It's a lot of things that happen that you don't expect. A lot of ups, but also a lot of downs. I think she was perfectly equipped to be his partner and all of that, and has been a huge factor in his career. And it wasn't really in any way a sure thing they would even meet or get to know each other well, because they knew each other before the Olympics in Sydney in 2000. But that's when their relationship really blossomed. And she was a last-minute addition to the Swiss Olympic team because other players withdrew. If that hadn't happened, would they have really come together? And also, would Roger have been the player he could have been?
Right, absolutely.
Don't know, but there's that element of chance, mm-hmm. that comes along. That throughout the book, I keep coming back at the thread of that.
For sure. You certainly recount some interesting stories about Roger Federer as a young man growing up who was much more temperamental than he would ultimately be as a mature champion. And I especially enjoy several different points in which He does things he was not supposed to do, including one incident in which he threw a racket and damaged a specially constructed backdrop, and was punished by having to clean the whole facility, toilets and all. And you sum up that story by saying it's a reminder that the rules, in Switzerland at least, also applied to young tennis geniuses. And you say that it probably made a difference that some of the people in young Roger Federer's life were not going to mollycoddle him or enable him or give him a free pass just because he was so brilliantly talented. Or maybe from time to time they would. But, I mean, there were the right people around him guiding this young man to greater maturity.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's a hallmark of Roger's behavior as an adult, is his respect for other people and his respect for the sport and the process. I mean, like everybody, he has his moments, but generally it's been an amazingly clean run that way. And I think it comes from childhood, the way his parents raised him. They made some exceptions, but they didn't make that many exceptions. And I think they made him realize it was important how you behaved and treated other people. And that situation, that incident you describe, is a classic one. That was in Biel at the Swiss National Training Center, which was a brand-new establishment. When Roger was 16 years old, he moved there. And he was, obviously one of the geniuses in residence there. But he got mad, as he often did, threw his racket. And as he said, it was like a hot knife slicing through butter. Went right back to the screen and tore a new hole in it. And they'd all been warned, and Roger was no exception. But the worst part of that punishment was not the cleaning the toilets. It was that he had to get up, I think, at 6 a.m. to do it, which he would say himself, he is still not a morning person. That was the worst part of that punishment, for
Interesting.
Sure.
Another real key to understanding Roger Federer's greatness is who he is as a physical specimen. And, of course, just to look at him, he does not have, for instance, the imposing physique of a Rafael Nadal. But he has a body that has very seldom let him down. And he is still, of course, playing at a remarkable level all these years later. At least early on, one of the people that was most helpful to him was a gentleman by the name of Pierre Paganini, who worked both with Roger Federer and with Stan Wawrinka, another great Swiss player, physically completely different, which really says something about Paganini's expertise, that he could work with a wide range of athletes. But one of the things you quote him in talking about is that there are two things you need as you work on yourself physically for the game of tennis. You need endurance and you need explosiveness, two qualities that you term as antagonistic. And somehow Roger Federer has really managed to nurture both of these sides of his physicality, and that's probably a really good explanation for his longevity and consistency over the years.
Yeah, that's very well described, Greg. That's exactly what Pierre was talking about. And they do seem very oppositional, don't they, in a sense. And that's the way tennis is. I mean, tennis is bursts of action for maybe if you hit a service winner, it's 3 or 4 seconds of action, and then you stop for 25 seconds. If you play a longer rally, you're talking about maybe 45 seconds of action, and then you take a break again. And you do this throughout, a three-hour match, or sometimes matches can go to even 5 hours at the best of five level. So that is the real interesting thing about tennis. It's this constant, full-speed, high-energy exertions followed by a break, and that's repeated throughout. And honestly, surprising though it might seem, a lot of physical trainers and fitness trainers, when Roger was emerging on tour, a lot of them still didn't take all that into account. I don't think they constructed their training program specifically for the rhythm of tennis. And I don't think there's really a whole lot of value, I think trainers would say now, in a tennis player going for a 5-mile run through the woods or whatever, to maybe mentally it helps you get stronger. But in terms of what you need for tennis, it doesn't help you with that explosive quickness and ability to recover that you're trying to create. And Pierre Paganini, who really is one of the, the trident, if you will, with Mirka and Peter Carter, of the most important people in Roger's career. He met Roger when Roger was just 14 years old and has been the longest standing member of his team. And Pierre was coming from a background as a former decathlete of track and field. He wasn't a tennis guy by any means. He wasn't steeped in it. So I think he had this ability to look at the sport with an outsider's lens, kind of like when you land in a new country you've never been to, you see everything in a fresh way. And he was able to look at the sport and say, okay, what do you really need here? What is the way to train for this sport that really fits the sport? And his conclusion was it all needed to be directly applicable. A lot of it needed to be done on court in kind of a match situation where you were repeating the fitness and matching the fitness to the sport's requirements. And Roger basically had this treatment from his early years. So that's a huge advantage compared to players he was competing against who hadn't had that maybe until later in their career, if at all. And I think Pierre and Roger made it very clear early on that they wanted Roger to have a long and fruitful career. And another thing they really focused on was recovery and the importance of taking breaks, not just physically, but mentally from the tour in order to be able to, when you did perform, you performed at your best with energy and optimism. And they were very strategic about that. And I think that's another huge key to what he's been able to accomplish.
That brings to mind an interesting moment in the book when you tell us about the concerns of some of the officials of the Swiss Tennis Federation when Roger Federer won the junior championship at Wimbledon in 1998. As typically happens, he didn't just smoothly and immediately graduate from junior titles to men's titles at that Grand Slam level. And they had some concerns that other champions like Pete Sampras, Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, by this point in their careers, had had Grand Slam singles titles. And Roger Federer had not reached that level yet, even though he clearly had brilliant talent. And Peter Carter's answer to their concern was that Roger Federer was on a different timetable. What a perceptive thing for him to understand, and what a difference it made for him in terms of not trying to rush Roger Federer to meet up with the timetables of these other earlier champions.
Yeah, and what a poignant, ultimately very sad thing that Peter Carter never got to see Roger, you know, fulfill his timetable, because Peter Carter really had it all mapped out and he understood it. And his death really, you know, he wasn't around to see it. I find that very poignant for me that they never had that moment to share that great success. He died before Roger Federer's first Grand Slam singles title at Wimbledon in 2003. But you're right. I think why was that timetable different? Partly because of Roger's emotional obstacles that we talked about already, you know, Greg, in terms of what he had to conquer in himself to be able to play his best tennis. And that was one element of it. And the other element was, I think, the fact that he has a very complete game, and he was working with the whole canvas, if you will, if you want to call him a tennis artist, somebody worked with the whole canvas and was able to be comfortable in all parts of the court and be dangerous from all parts of the court. That's where he really evolved the game. But all those options and choices in your head as a tennis player, you know, we all know who play the game. I mean, that just makes it more complicated. You got that many things to think about, which you might be able to do. Most of us don't have that many options, so, you know, it makes it easy to – I was a limited college player, so I can relate to that pretty well. And I had only a couple things I could do well, so I did them. Well, as Roger can do most things well. And so he had to kind of work through, under pressure, against the best players in the world, what option to choose. And that took time. Mm. And he also was an attacking player, and he was somebody who didn't have a huge Boris Becker-like serve or a John Isner-like serve. He had a amazing serve, but very precise, relied on precision and placement. So he had to find a way to work through all these moving parts of his game. It took time, but when it started to happen for real in 2003, he just took off. Hmm. And I think that was when the maturity process arrived at its conclusion that way.
Absolutely. And, of course, he's carried on so superbly well over the years. And it's interesting, one of the first sports psychologists he worked with, Christian Marcoli, paid him such an interesting compliment many, many years later when he said that, you know, for as impressed as I am with how well you are playing the game on the court, how you handle your life, I mean, outside of the court, I mean, everything else that is part of being a tennis pro at this level, is just amazing to him, that is to Christian Marcoli, and I think to a lot of people. And that's one of the things you talk about at the beginning of the book, is how in so many ways Roger Federer derives energy from the world travel and visiting all these different places and so on, which to many other players, most players, is a draining experience. And to him, it is somehow energizing, and it's one of the reasons why he still loves the tour and loves the game of tennis all these years later. Tell us more about that facet of Roger Federer that really sets him apart from so many of his competitors.
You know, part of that is nature, in the sense, not nurture, that he's somebody who, you know, I think, has that kind of character. He's got that gregarious nature, empathetic quality to him that allows him to relate to people from all different parts of the world, different, you know, walks of life. That's part of it. But I think it also comes from his parents in the sense that his parents are travelers. You know, they love it. They love to get out there and see the world. And before Roger became a star, the whole family went down to Australia and traveled from Switzerland. His parents met in South Africa and then traveled back and forth quite a lot. So Roger was exposed to different influences from the earliest age. He also grew up in Basel, which is a city right on the border with France and Germany. You can literally do your shopping, you know, in either one of those countries if you're in Basel. And he grew up with those languages and those cultures all around him. So he's been exposed to that kind of mixture of things from the earliest age, and that's certainly a factor in his love of traveling the world because he feels at ease in that environment, something he knows very well. It's like, you know, swimming in your local pool or your local river. So that's an aspect of it. But I think also it's a matter of mindset and how you approach things. And this is what I try to take away from when I finished the book in my own life. I got to travel in economy class, not in luxury, but I have to travel in economy class all over the world. And basically, he's able, I think, to realize, and this is very intelligent and harder to do than it sounds, I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to need to go through the jet lag. I'm going to have to go travel around the world and play this tournament. I'm going to have to drag my family with me and find a way to educate them on the road and keep them happy while I'm playing my tournament. And I got to give this news conference again after a match I might even have lost in three languages. And other players, I got to tell you, just do not handle all that well. And Roger has. And I think it's because he's decided, he has his nature, but he also has his will that he's going to find these things, value in these things that others might find a bit grueling and frustrating. Mm. And he's really, really good at that. And I think that's something he's gotten better at through the years. And I can tell you, I've been with him in situations. I mean, I rode in his private plane with his agent to go to Chicago for a story on his business dealings for the Times. And he got up at crack of dawn or before dawn, get on the plane, just lost a match to Del Potro the day before. And we get in Chicago, and the guy's, you know, on the tarmac, and he's saying, "Oh, isn't it great to see a new city and a new place?" And he wasn't kidding. You know, it's just, he's not like other people, or not like a lot of other people anyway, at the highest level in sport.
Right. It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes in the book, which is from American Paul Anacone, who I think worked with Roger Federer for a time. And he says at one point, Roger Federer is interesting, that is, he is an interesting person, because he's interested. That is, he is interested in other people and interested in the world beyond the confines of the tennis court. And that's one of the first compliments you pay about Roger Federer early in the book, when you say that unlike just about any other elite athlete, Roger Federer will be very quick to ask you about you. And it's not always about the spotlight being on him. He seems to have a genuine interest in the world around him and the people around him. And that has somehow energized him over the course of this long career.
I think that's right. I think if you're going to be in all these situations and meeting all these people, and I don't think it's just applies to journalists. I think it's people he meets, you know, in the course of his day who are not writing stories about him. Of course, there's a PR element to that if you're doing that, but I don't think that's really what it's all about. I think it's also just a general curiosity that he has, and he likes to learn. He wasn't a great student by any means, as the book makes clear, and he would immediately confess to that in academic terms, but he's kind of used the tennis tour and the world in which he travels as kind of a school of life, and I think that's been another key to his long-running success.
I so appreciate the fact that your book tells us all kinds of things, not only about his game, but also about the way he has lived and continues to live his life. That is part of what makes this book so remarkable. Again, it's titled The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer, published by 12, and the author, Christopher Clary. Christopher Clary, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book. I think lots of people will read it and love it as I did. And thank you for being part of the morning show. It was great to talk with you.
It was my pleasure, my honor, Greg. Thanks again for your compliments about the book. It means a lot. And it was the hardest thing I've done in 30-plus years of my career, trying to sum up all his long run and this era in men's tennis. But it's been a privilege to cover it.
Hmm. Well, this book is a gratifying success for you. So thank you again for talking about it on the morning show.
All the best to you, Greg.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out the program, I want to replay for you a portion of a 2010 conversation which I recorded with L. John Wertheim, executive editor of Sports Illustrated, talking about his remarkable book Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. The subtitle refers to the Wimbledon men's final of 2008, in which Rafael Nadal triumphed over Roger Federer in five hard-fought sets. This match is still regarded by many as the greatest tennis match ever played. The book is not only an interesting chronicle of that specific match, but also a very perceptive portrait of both of these tennis geniuses. Let's talk about each of these players and just a few of the observations which you make about them. I think you make a very interesting observation. I think actually you might be quoting someone else and saying that Roger Federer, who is Swiss, plays tennis that is quintessentially Swiss. That was somebody else's observation, but do you care to explain how Roger Federer is, as a player, quintessentially Swiss?
To lapse into stereotype, but you sort of think about Swiss characteristics, and there's a sort of precision and this punctuality. You think of a Swiss watch and all the gears going in order, and the real, I mean, I guess precision is the word I always come back to. You think about sort of a certain neutrality, a certain diplomacy, all the characteristics that, you know, the guy on the street would associate with Switzerland sure applies awfully well to Federer's personality and his tennis.
I was really struck by this observation. You said, to his parents' frustration, Federer was an indifferent, restless student in school, not dim, but not particularly dedicated. Tennis, however, fed something in him and commanded his full attention. I think that is the way it plays out with a whole lot of people, that you achieve greatness in the thing that you most love to do. But I especially love that idea about tennis for Roger Federer being something that commanded his full attention. In the end, that's probably what all of us need to find, is that thing that draws us to it in the way that tennis drew Roger Federer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other interesting thing is that for all the, you know, the quote-unquote tennis parents, for all these sort of hardcore sports parents that are arranging for extra batting practice and hiring nutritionists and pushing their kids, the Federers were the opposite. I mean, this is sort of a well-educated, middle-class family, and, you know, they wanted him to be a better student, and if he happened to like tennis, well, fine, you can ride your bike to the club after school, but, you know, we ain't pulling you out of class so you can hit a ball across the net. And it ended up that sort of, in a weird way, that hands-off approach probably motivated him more than anything. And, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of his friends sort of joked, if this had been 10 years later, he would have had a, you know, ADHD diagnosis, that he was, you know, not a dumb guy by any stretch, but just one of those kids in school that's restless, had a hard time sitting still. And the tennis court, he could get out there and obviously had some of the hand-eye coordination and some of the natural talent, but also just sort of being there and running around. And he was part of a tennis team, but there weren't, you know, they're obviously not teammates, so you sort of have collegiality and the camaraderie without depending on someone to pass you the ball or play defense. And tennis just sort of clicked for him. And you hear him talk about his love of the game, and it's clear, as you said, this was sort of, he feels like he's found the one thing in life he was cut out to do. And obviously, you know, we should all be so lucky.
Yeah, I like how you said at one point that his parents were not pushy. If anything, they were pulley. If they nudged him at all, it was to stop taking tennis so seriously. But of course, tennis itself seemed to have another idea. A couple other observations about Roger Federer, which I really appreciated as I reread your book. One thing you said is that the first title, major title, which Roger Federer won, his first title at Wimbledon, and was that back in 2003, I think? You
right.
said that, in a sense, this first title had a catalytic effect, as if a spigot had been tapped. Tell us what happened once Roger Federer had won this first major title at Wimbledon. What did that seem to do for him?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because people seem to forget now that there were about, you know, it sort of reminds me of Michael Jordan in the beginning and certainly LeBron James now, where there were a few years there, not obviously LeBron James in 7 years, but there were a few years when it was sort of like, okay, this Federer guy's talented and everybody's talking about what he does on the practice court, but, you know, time to put up or shut up. But there'd been a lot of disappointing results, and he was just sort of been known as the guy who had a lot of talent and was he ever going to do anything with it. And then people forget he had a terrible loss in the first round of the French Open that year in 2003, and people were really giving up on him and saying this guy's just a talented head case. And then 4 weeks later, he goes and wins Wimbledon, and it was just sort of, you know, some players reach the top, especially in tennis, and they just sort of say, great, I've achieved it, and now everything else is gravy, and they have a hard time sustaining it. And he sort of had the opposite reaction, which is, I've got to the top of the mountain, now I know what I have to do to get here, and you know, I'm going to stay here for a while. So once he, you know, this was his first Grand Slam final in 2003, he wins that match, and then it was just lights out. I mean, then that started this era we're in now that, you know, 7 years later has made him the best player ever.
It's just interesting to think about how that worked for him, because one also thinks about certain players who win one major singles title and then, for whatever reason, don't quite managed to follow it up. I mean, a Michael Chang with one and only one French Open title, or Andy Roddick, or let's see, has he won more than one U.S. Open title?
One U.S. Open.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it is. It doesn't always work this way, but it sure worked for Roger Federer.
Right. I mean, the other thing too that we see is players sort of yo-yo up and down. I mean, Andre Agassi was, obviously sort of the prime example of that, but other players too, they're up, they're down, you know, the Williams sisters, they have some injuries. I mean, Serena at one point, you know, was way outside the top 50, you know, Roger Federer has been either number one or number two for 6.5-7 years now. So apart from winning consistently, he also stayed up there in the rankings and didn't have one of these sort of dips and yo-yo careers that we also see a lot of.
You tell us that as Federer achieved greatness, one of the things that is most striking about him is that his entourage is, in your words, strikingly bare. I mean, he certainly has the means to be thickly insulated by an entourage that would sort of keep the world away. In fact, Federer does not operate that way.
Yeah, you know, as far as I'm concerned, yet another reason to like the guy, that he sort of said, look, I'm at the top with just a few people around me, and it'll stay that way. He finally got an agent. He kind of sort of has a coach. His wife travels with him, but she also does administrative work. And, you know, that's really about it. There are a lot of players who aren't ranked nearly as high, who have a lot more people around him. And I think, you know, I mean, I think it says a lot about who he is and what motivates him, but I also think that there's a real element of sort of self-sufficiency. I mean, he likes finding out solutions for himself. He likes sort of figuring out everything from, you know, tactics to stringing. I think he doesn't want to be reliant on anyone else. And, you know, again, it's another reason, as far as I'm concerned, it's another reason to be fond of the guy. That, as you say, you're right. I mean, here's a guy who makes tens of millions of dollars. He could have the personal, he could have the personal chef and, you know, the personal masseuse and the whole team traveling with him as other players do. And he just sort of wants to keep it simple. And I think his attitude too, and I think this goes for a lot of things with him, is just why mess with success? You know, this arrangement's done well for me. This racket's done well for me. Why do I need to tinker just because I might have the money or the opportunity to do so?
Hmm. Rafael Nadal, you say, is often described as freakish, his genius in tennis described as freakish and fluky in a raised by wolves kind of way. And the fact that when one thinks about Rafael Nadal, very seldom do you say, oh, he reminds me of player X. I mean, he is very much a sort of a one-of-a-kind player. And yet you tell us Nadal's game is the opposite of alien. It's homemade and meticulously handcrafted. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, again, we sort of think about the tennis player, and you think about driven parents, and at a young age, the kid goes off to some academy and drops out of school and hits walls for, you know,
1,000 hours and with Nadal and Federer both, they just came to this point by such an unusual way. And, you know, Federer's case, he just had this sort of middle-class upbringing in Switzerland. And in Nadal's case, you know, he comes from this small Spanish island, comes from Mallorca. There really hadn't been, hadn't been a big tennis history there. He has an uncle who certainly knows tennis but wasn't a pro or anything like that. Convert him from a righty to a lefty, which turned out to be a genius, and then sort of taught him these strokes. I mean, nobody hits the ball like Nadal has, and nobody is in, you know, right now nobody's emulating him. It's a very unique way he plays tennis. And it's one of these things where you could scratch your head. You could say, hey, you've got a kid this talented. You should put him in an academy. But the family sort of did it their own way. And again, you can't really argue with the results, but both Federer and Nadal cut a very different figure from what we're used to in tennis. I mean, there's sort of, and the Williams sisters too, for that matter. So if the top four players all came to their success so differently than sort of the conventional way, maybe the lesson from this is the conventional way needs to be reconsidered.
Hmm. I especially appreciated the rules that were laid down by Rafael Nadal's uncle Tony, three in particular. And in some respects, the first says so much about this family. Uncle Tony's first rule for his nephew: if you ever throw a racket, we're finished. They're expensive, and when you throw a racket, you don't just disrespect the sport, you disrespect all the people who cannot afford equipment. That is a rule that should probably be stenciled in a lot of places where tennis is taught.
Yeah, exactly, and I think I think that says a lot. Not just in terms of the decorum, but just sort of in terms of the whole philosophy. I mean, Nadal's uncle, who really, in some ways, is sort of a surrogate parent. I mean, this is the guy who coached him and traveled the world with him, and I guess a close knit family. And I think the uncle basically, you know, he has this sort of my way or the highway mentality, and the uncle sort of again. They don't come from traditional tennis stock. This is not a family that's sort of grown up. I mean, they're well off, but they didn't grow up with a lot of the, you know, material conveniences and status. And I think the uncle was very important to him that no matter where his kid's career got, that he kept his values. And, I've seen the guy in action, too. He means business. I mean, there are times where Nadal will forget his water bottle in the locker room, and they'll go out to the practice courts, and someone will fetch it for him, and the uncle will wave the port attendant off and said, no, this was Rafael's responsibility, and he blew it. He's going to go in and get it. So you see the number one player in the world running across the tennis complex to get a water bottle because his uncle doesn't want him to feel like he can depend on others to cover up his errors.
Another decision his uncle made, you tell us that he did not want tennis to come too easily to Rafael, and so he would, for instance, make his nephew practice with dead balls and on pocked courts that gave dishonest bounces. In other words, he saw value in placing before his nephew obstacles that might create momentary frustrations, but which he obviously thought would further stiffen his spine and force him to achieve even greater skill.
Yeah, I mean, the uncle had a philosophy, which I think is very smart, which is, look, on the days when everything's clicking and you're feeling great and you got a good night's sleep and the conditions are perfect, you know, anyone can go out there and play good tennis. It's the winners and losers are being determined by who can play their best tennis when everything's not going well, when there's some obstacles and some adversity you've got to figure out a way to surmount. So, you know, Nadal would have a great practice, and the uncle would shrug and say, hey, it was a beautiful day, and you got a good night's sleep. I expect you to be good, but what are you going to do now when I play you with these dead balls and I'm aiming for the cracks in the court, so they're going to take some funny hops? And I think that's certainly expresses itself in the way Nadal plays today.
Hmm. Most of your book, of course, is dedicated to this incredible match, blow by blow, set by set. You take us through this drama, and one of the things I think you achieve that's truly amazing is that anybody who follows tennis knows how this match is going to end, and yet somehow you've created an account of this match which reads like a thriller, or I mean like a suspense novel, even though obviously there can't be too much in the way of real suspense in terms of how this is going to turn out. Was that something you consciously tried to do?
No, I appreciate that. I mean, the map sort of packed it for itself, and just the turns and the twists that this match took were so naturally suspenseful. But no, you're right. I mean, it's like I said earlier, that nobody wants to hear in the third game Nadal hit a backhand down the line and Federer responded with a forehand. I mean, it had to be more than just sort of play-by-play. First of all, because you're right, everybody sort of knew the outcome already, but also just, it, you know, probably doesn't make for interesting reading. So I think, you know, the match itself really unfolded like a thriller. And, you know, as trite as it sounds, I do have a new respect for the phrase, you know, a shame someone had to lose. Because, you know, again, a lot of cliches there, but you do, they both played well enough to win.
Absolutely. You take us not only through the match, but also through its immediate aftermath. And one of the things that we come away with is their graciousness, but particularly the exquisite sensitivity which Rafael Nadal, the victor, demonstrated towards his vanquished foe. And a lot of tennis players would not have been so careful about their opponent's feelings. Tell our listeners, for instance, what Rafael Nadal did in terms of giving Federer space in those few minutes once after they had both left the court.
Yeah, they had bolted from the court, and you know, it was clear that Federer was really rocked by this defeat, and Nadal's entourage was outside the locker room, and they had champagne, and someone from the club had brought them, you know, a tray of champagne glasses, and Nadal sort of shushed them and told them to be quiet. And then the Wimbledon locker room, especially for the Steve, is a fairly small enclosure. And Nadal ended up, you know, he sort of went around in his sweaty clothes because he didn't want to take a shower. He wanted to just sort of give Federer his space. And I thought between sort of telling his family to pipe down because it was too close to Federer and it would be pouring salt in his wounds, and then just sort of leaving the locker room alone and just sort of doing his business. And I mean, I think Nadal didn't change till about an hour after the match because he wanted to give Federer his space. I thought that really showed a lot.
In a sense, that makes it even less surprising when there is that extraordinary moment between these two players after the Australian Open. And I think it was the very next Australian Open where Nadal is again the victor and Roger Federer actually breaks down in tears during the trophy presentation. And the gentle, encouraging words of Rafael Nadal. I mean, if there had ever been any doubt, there shouldn't have been, but if there was any kind of doubt about what kind of a gentleman Rafael Nadal is, surely those doubts were put to rest that night of that Australian Open final.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That Federer, you know, Nadal beat Federer again. Again, it was five sets, and you got the feeling between the emotions of the match and Federer sort of realizing, boy, this kid's really got my number. Federer just lost it at the trophy presentation. I mean, just crying to the point he couldn't speak. And Nadal, you know, covered for him, sort of took the microphone and then very gracefully sort of made the best of that situation. I think the other thing that's really nice is that, you know, both these players have had successes since that Wimbledon 2008. Nadal won in Australia. He won the Olympic gold medal. He's number one today as we speak, and yet Federer also has had successes since then, winning the French Open. He's a defending champ at Wimbledon, so it was nice that they had this tremendous match, this great rivalry, this sort of epic Wimbledon final, and yet it didn't really, you know, spell doom for the loser. They both were able to sort of thrive since then, and you know, their rivalry still goes strong. So, I mean, I think one of the nice things about this story is Federer losing that match, he's, you know, clearly pained, clearly there's been some sort of changing of the guard, and yet it wasn't the final chapter in their story.
L. John Wertheim is author of Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played, published by Mariner Books. I'm Gregory Berg. Monday on the morning show, I'll be speaking with Ron Roy, who is author of a very, very popular series of books for children called The A to Z Mysteries. Also, Blythe Grossberg and her wonderful memoir called I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. For a number of years, she was one of the busiest tutors in New York City, tutoring the children of some of the wealthiest